The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his excellent qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, "O King Darius, live forever! The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days anyone who prays to any god or man except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to the king and said to him, "Remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near to the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. May the Lord give us open hearts to consider his word. My focal text this morning is Daniel 6, verse 10. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. 3 times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Now, the faculty has decreed by the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed, that you must read 4,000 pages of reading. You must write 5 30-page papers. And you must undergo 8 major examinations. This poses you with a dilemma. Either you obey the decree by putting everything else aside, having no conversations with your spouse, getting 5 hours of sleep a night, and chucking your time of prayer and quiet devotion to the Lord. Or else, you may refuse to obey the decree, in which case, at the end of the term, you will be thrown into the den of the lions of grading, and they will tear you limb from limb. Well, seriously, how is your prayer life? And if it's in good shape now, what will it be like at the end of the term? And we should remember that the Lord Jesus counseled us that we must not merely heap up words as the Gentiles do, thinking that they'll be heard for their many words. That what God is looking for in prayer is not a multiplication of time in prayer or words in prayer for its own sake, but he's looking for a genuine communion with himself. He's looking for a humble and contrite heart, as the prophet Isaiah says. And when you look at your own heart, and when I look at mine, we can all find reason to be dissatisfied or even ashamed at what we've been doing. So what about Daniel? What about this story? What can we learn here? What is the point? Well, one of the questions may arise is whether Daniel is really intended to serve as an example in this story. Now, this story is a nice story. It's one of the favorite stories, especially of children. Everybody likes a hero, a Superman or a Lone Ranger or somebody that can solve their problems. But if it comes a little too close to home and you're saying you must be like this hero is a model for you, then it can get uncomfortable. But I do believe, in some respects at least, that Daniel is intended to serve as a model, because Daniel was not alone in the pressures which confronted him. There were temptations to idolatry, temptations to cave into the surrounding culture that besetted every Jew in the exile. And this book of Daniel, as you may know, is written in an exilic context where many of Jews must have been asking, is God still with us? Does God really care about us? Is it any use praying? Is it any use serving him anymore? Especially if there is pressure, and sometimes pressure even with the threat of death behind it, pressure to worship idols in order to show your loyalty to the culture and to the empire, the mighty and seemingly impregnable empire of which you're a part. And Daniel stood firm in that. Daniel stood firm even in the face of the threat of death. And, we may think about our own situation and say many of us many times are not standing very firm when the threat is not death, but the threat is television and busyness and very superficial things. Now, to be sure, when you become a seminary student, you have the excuse that you're devoting yourself to the work of God, and it's easier to evade some of the poverty that may characterize our spiritual life. But if you look at what it's like for you before seminary or apart from seminary, you look at some of your friends, if you're doing okay right now, then surely we're presented with some of the same challenges, but in much more subtle, much more insidious form. Much less pressure in one respect, but because it's not so obvious a pressure, maybe more insidious. Now, there's another question that arises, at least in my mind. Did Daniel really have to do what he did? Surely he could have prayed silently. He could have just closed down the windows. And, if he had his good theology, you know God hears a silent prayer, and he didn't have to see in the distance out in the direction of Jerusalem. Couldn't he have just gone into his closet and not created this stir? Wasn't it rather foolish of Daniel, in fact, to provoke his enemies? Well, I suspect, there's nothing in the text directly, but I suspect that Daniel realized that it was not only his own person and life that was at stake, but the lives of Jews throughout the kingdom. And that even he, if he escaped through some kind of subterfuge, his fellow countrymen would not. And so at this point, perhaps he was willing to put himself in the breach and to say, I'm going to make an issue of it, because if I don't make an issue of it, it's going to be disaster for the entire people of God. And you see, in that respect, he's not only a model to imitate, but in a sense, he's a point man. He's the lightning rod. It's a little bit like the situation in 1 Kings 22, when the king of Aram is fighting against the king of Israel and the armies of Israel, and he instructs all his commanders, now I don't want you to fight with anybody except the king of Israel. You get him, and the battle is over. And Daniel becomes that lightning rod, that focus for the powers of his opponents, but underlying them, of course, the power of Satan. And he's willing to do it. He's willing to do it and to put himself on the line and his own life on the line. Why is that? He trusted in God, it said. There's something else here, however, and that is sort of the issue. Is the issue of prayer here really significant? It seems the real issue is this political one of envy of Daniel and so on. Is this really a lesson about prayer or not? Well, in some respects, it's not. And it's an issue of loyalty. And in other passages in Daniel, you can see that the issue of loyalty takes other forms. One time in Daniel 1, it's the issue of what kind of food you're going to eat. One time, it's the issue of whether you're going to bow down to an idol or be cast into the fiery furnace. One time, it's the issue with Nebuchadnezzar. Is he going to acknowledge God or not? Here, it's the issue of who you pray to and whether you're willing to continue in your life of worshiping God in prayer. So that, in a sense, prayer stands alongside of all these other issues. But, of course, in this circumstance and in this situation, it becomes the focal point. It becomes the key. Now, we may also ask ourselves, well, really, where's the power in this case? It's not indicated that Daniel's prayers had any particular power. And in fact, from a worldly point of view, not only was what Daniel did rather stupid, but it didn't really take into account the power struggle that was involved. First of all, the power of the king. From the standpoint of a worldling, the king had absolute power. What he said went. But it's a little bit ironic that in this story, the king is bested. It's clear that his limitations come out. There are things he doesn't anticipate. And so back of the king stands the power of the lions, which even the king can't get around. And back of the lions, there stands the power of the opponents, who in their cleverness were able to manipulate everything so, at least as they thought, things were all going in their direction. And in this situation, Daniel becomes the focus of all those powers that are arrayed against him. How can praying three times a day stand up to that kind of focus of power? Well, I think the passage taken as a whole gives us some hints, and in a rather exciting and strange way. Because if you look over into the next chapter in Daniel 7, Daniel has a dream that begins with a vision of a lion. And you can imagine that Daniel, when he sees this lion, can't quite emotionally get over his experience of being in that lion's den all night long. And it's like to say, I wonder whether this lion has any connection. And as the dream develops, it turns out that there are not only a lion, but three other beasts that appear and come up out of the waters of the chaos of the sea in Daniel 7. Each beast representing a kingdom that is warring against the people of God. And the first kingdom, lo and behold, is the kingdom of Babylon, under which Daniel did his service, and kingdom represented by King Darius, who had prepared this den of lions. That first kingdom is itself a lion. And that den of lions is but a small-scale picture of the lion-like power of the Babylonian Empire threatening to devour the people of God in its midst, threatening to devour them in its idolatry. This beast, this lion, comes out of the waters of the sea, out of the waters of chaos, out of the abyss of evil. And I believe there's already a hint there that basically what you already know, that back of these opponents of Daniel, with their selfishness and their envy, that they too become tools of the demonic powers, of the satanic enemies that are trying to destroy the people of God. And it's as if Daniel 7 escalates the whole conflict and says, I want you to look underneath of what was going on with this one man, Daniel, and I want you to see that there's a spiritual war going on, and that it's a war that also touches on our flesh and blood, that can result in literal death, in martyrdom of Daniel or someone else who is smashed by the power of the state as it persecutes the people of God. Four different beasts, one after another, rise, as if to say that the people of God are only going to find relief temporarily, and then and again, they're going to be hit with satanic opposition. Until verse 9. Because God is still on his throne. And the seats are set for judgment. The books opened. Judgment is given against the beasts. And then in verse 13, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. Daniel had come as a deliverer and as a representative of the people of God in his own day. But now in this dream, Daniel sees behind himself and beyond himself to another representative figure. To a man, to a final man who will achieve a deliverance not once and temporarily leading to a temporary prosperity, but will achieve a deliverance that will destroy all these beasts. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So where's the power struggle? Is it King Darius that we must obey? Is it the lions? Is it the opponents? Is it none of the above? Right? That's what Daniel is saying. None of the above. There is an everlasting kingdom that will destroy all the kingdoms of the world. But before the coming of this kingdom in its fullness, Daniel also says that there's going to be great suffering. Verse 25, for instance, he, that is the fourth beast, and the horn on the beast, will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. But then he will be destroyed. There is to be suffering, in other words, deep suffering, before the triumph of the kingdom of God. Daniel doesn't go into all the details of how this suffering is to take place. But as you look forward in history and you come to the New Testament and you find the coming of one who titles himself the Son of Man, Jesus Christ, and who says, far from raising an army to drive out the Romans, that the Christ must suffer many things and be crucified and buried. And to do so because he's the point man, because he's the representative, because he's the lightning rod, not this time for the anger of the opponents and the anger of the lions alone, but this time for the anger of God himself against your sin, against mine. Daniel goes down into that den, below the surface of the earth, into a grave, virtually. He's as good as dead, but God preserves him from death. But the Son of Man goes down into that grave and dies. The king, Darius, is rooting for Daniel all the way through. Jesus has nobody to root for him. Even his disciples leave him. But Jesus did not remain in the grave. On the third day, he rose from the dead. He was drawn up out of the grave in a way that exceeds by far the fact that Daniel was preserved in that den of lions. And Daniel answered, verse 21, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and he shut the mouths of the lions. And you may hear the words of Christ out of that. My Father has by his promise guarded me even through death. And they have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight. And Jesus may have said, death has not been able to hold me because I was found innocent in his sight. The king is overjoyed. Daniel is lifted up because he trusted in his God.